Hello, dear internet strangers. Today is Tuesday, May 31st, and we are Talking in Obscurity, companion podcast to the blog Writing in Obscurity. I'm Kevin Carlson, and I'm joined by my co-host,
Steve Kubitz.
Today, we're talking about John Campbell's Who Goes There, the novella that inspired John Carpenter's The Thing.
So, like anyone else, I'm sure we've all seen The Thing, and I've never actually sought out to read the short story.
Yeah.
And yeah. We have a mutual friend who loves horror, like loves horror films, horror movies, and he always talked about this story with kind of a little bit of disdain, just a little, like an odd, like not. He always seems to kind of like really lean into how much he doesn't like it.
I'm riveted by this because I have no idea where you're going,
and so I've kind of avoided it for a long time because I'm like, oh, it's gonna suck, and finally sitting out and reading it, I realized that like. I think it's unfair harshness because you know this story is much more dated than the movie.
Yeah,
I think it still really tells a good story, and I really enjoyed getting to finally.
Oh, you mean the novella? Novella. He doesn't like the novella. Yeah. Right.
It felt fun to finally get the chance to sort of like dive into this origin story of one of the greatest horror films of all time, because that's what it kind of felt like to me.
Yeah, I love The Thing. It is my favorite horror film. Is The Thing. I love this story because John Carpenter's The Thing is actually very close to it. By the way, we're starting our thing now. This is my first love.
Our thing. Boom, boom.
The novella is pretty close to John Carpenter's interpretation of it, which is certainly done decades later, and there were movies, because this is a 1930s novella.
Yeah.
I love how faithful he was, and by the way, John Carpenter's The Thing isn't the first one.
No, there was The Thing from Space or something like that.
Yeah, and it was more of a Frankenstein.
Because it came out in like the '50s, when like the height of that kind of like pop sort of horror.
Yeah, but like Who Goes There? If you love that 1980s movie like I do, it's very close to that experience.
You know, for me, like the thing I like about this a lot, I feel like every time we say thing, I feel like there should be a little like ding for how many times you say it. But the thing I really enjoy about this story so much is the atmosphere is just as creepy as, to me, as the movie. There's so much ambiance and there's so much stuff going on. It really does a good job of building that sort of... Spoilers, I'm sure if you haven't seen The Thing, we're not going to get in the spoiler section of this, but you know the gist of it is. And this really builds tension between sort of that mistrust and all about the person you are looking at isn't always what they appear.
Yeah,
and it really does a good job of raising that tension. It is, especially as like the people don't sleep as much, they don't sleep for days, they're never alone, and they're already in kind of a, because it's Antarctica, they're already kind of in a cramped space. So this magnifies that claustrophobia and makes it even more insane, because you know something's amiss.
Yeah, the paranoia in this novella and Who Goes There is another love that I love it in the movie, and I love it in the actual novella of this story, because without like going into too many details of the plot, the crux of it is it's an imitation story. It's a sort of like a Attack of the Body Snatchers, where there is this alien that is a doppelganger of whatever it needs to be. But what I love the most about how Campbell does it, it isn't a copy that like has the normal like, oh, it does this one thing that's slightly weird, or it has these gaps in its memory. No, it's perfect. You could be talking to your best friend, who is now the thing, and it will remember every single detail perfectly. It will imitate your best friend perfectly. And I love how that feeds into the paranoia that anybody could be a thing.
I think what makes the story in general so brilliant, you know, is that sort of paranoia and that sort of distrust bleeds into the reader. Mm-hmm. Because you don't know any of the characters you're talking to. Any of them could be a thing. And there's something very... Usually when you're reading something, you're sort of this... over omnipotent presence where you know what's going on. You know more than the characters do because you're outside of it. But this story, you don't really know who's a thing, who's not a thing, what their motive, what the thing's motivation is. And that's kind of another, my sort of thing about it is that the thing feels so alien in this story. And it feels so like you don't fully comprehend what it wants.
The human characters, they speculate a lot about what its goals are, but they don't actually know.
Because how could you possibly know?
And the, I love that like air of incomprehensibility. Is they assume that this is the beginning of an alien invasion, and that certainly could be true, but it never monologues or explains what it's doing. It never acts out of character. It just goes from being your buddy, Bennings, just being Bennings, and then one day, and then suddenly, whenever it realizes it's caught, it turns into a monster. It doesn't then monologue. It just becomes a monster.
It becomes what it needs to become to avoid any the avoid conflict, basically.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, the thing, the monster, when it, if you've seen the movie, you sort of get an idea of what we're talking about, tentacles and all the weird things. That looks scary, and it is scary. But it's almost to a point where it's kind of like a dog showing you its fangs. It doesn't want to attack you. If in a perfect world, it wouldn't have to. Mm-hmm. But it wants you to be terrified of it, so you'll leave it alone.
Yeah. And everybody has their own speculation on it. And I think that's my feeling of, if I were to guess at its motivations, which I still think is foolhardy, but mainly it just wants to be left alone. It doesn't want to deal with these people. It just is forced to, and this is its thing. Oh, we're really going to say thing a lot.
Ding!
That's what it does, is it's this perfect mimicry.
And I think, back to the story a little bit, the other thing I really enjoy about this novella, It's part of the short story. Of course, you know, there's no filler in this. There's no let's build up to what's going on. It just throws you right in, and I love that because it makes you as a reader really off balance because you don't really understand. You're already in the middle of this story, but when you start the story, pretty much.
Yeah, and the movie does that with that whole helicopter chase at the beginning. And like, what is going on with this? Why are they chasing this dog? Why are they shooting at it? And the novella doesn't do that. Because it doesn't, they don't go to a second location and find, like, in the movie. They're the ones that just, they found the ship.
Yeah.
They found the thing. And we're now dealing with the fallout of the fact that they found that alien life is real. And unexpectedly terrifying.
Yeah, and I'll say that about, like, the monster, is that movie, book, whatever, the monster is threatening. It is legitimately it's a very scary monster. Even though I'll say that, you know, we'll get to the differences, you know, a little bit of the difference between the movie and the book, but the monster itself always has this air of just, you're scared of it. Because again, there's the scariest thing isn't that it's, to me, the scariest part of the monster isn't the tentacles and shooting and being creepy. It's the fact that several times it's having conversations with people, looking them in the eyes, and at any point any of these people could be the thing. And I think that is something inherently creepy, is that, like you said, it's not so much that, like, it's an invasion of the body snatchers where you can see that they're off. All of a sudden, they talk very monotone, and they're very boring, and their personality is very different. Yeah. Yeah. Like, that's scary, sure. But you can tell right away who's been body snatched.
Yeah.
Like, this was scary because you have no clue. If you have a scar on your left thigh that you got with your brother because you were, when you were playing as kids, the thing knows that story.
Yeah, and like, one of my favorite things that bleeds over from the novella in the movie is a character asks, if I were a thing, I'd know that I was a thing. And nobody knows how to answer that question. Does the thing that's imitating a human, is it doing it so perfectly that it itself is not consciously aware of it? It is an unknowable question.
That is a creepy thought, too. That you don't know until...
until you're threatened.
Yeah.
I love how... and we'll talk about this much more in our analysis section, is how selfish each entity of the thing is. The fact that it can write off other the things easily. Like, each thing is its own entity. They all come from the same initial source. They were all one entity at one point, but they, the nature of their power of mimicry, is they could split off, but just because they're both from the original creature doesn't mean they have the exact same motivation.
It's creepy because it's not like when you think of like a hive mind, you think of that sort of concept of the hive takes over the individual. But in this case, it's taking over people, and it's definitely part of a single entity, but every single entity only gives a shit about itself.
Yeah.
And like, that's inherently kind of a weird sort of dark reflection of humanity a little bit. That we are all kind of the same.
Part of a greater whole, but at the end of the day, it only really cares about itself.
Yeah, and there's definitely a, if you think about when the novella was written, coming off the Roaring Twenties, very hedonistic time.
Yeah.
You know, we still had that sort of, a lot of the sort of the same scares that became, you know, part of the more famous Red Scare, but we had that same kind of concept of, you know, things like that. So when you think about that, the whole concept of it makes a ton of sense. Mm-hmm. And like, not to get too analysis-y because, you know, we're not there yet, but like, that is something inherently very, it's evergreen.
Yeah.
We're always afraid of the thing that looks like us and is, that's what makes like xenophobia such a thing, is that it's not that we're afraid of these people because they're different. It's because they look kind of like us, but just a little bit off, mm-hmm. or a little bit different. So we have to hate them. But in reality, we all, most of us, you know, unless there's an accident or some deformity, 2 ears, 2 eyes, a nose and a mouth.
Yeah.
And we have a lot more in common than we don't, but it doesn't matter because at the end of the day, those people are different. And the thing kind of is that same sort of fear. That's what makes that sort of xenophobia so unnatural, really, is that at the end of the day, like, we're not that different, but gotta be scared of it.
Yeah. So you want to pivot into our dislikes?
Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
So my chief dislike of this is that the characters are not nearly as good in the novella as they are in the movie. Especially, so the main character in both is MacReady, and Campbell had this weird love for him. And I'm not saying that, like, you can't, a man can't love a man or anything like that, but, like, MacReady is the fucking best at everything. He's a fucking bronze god, he's a goddamn giant, and as much as I like Kurt Russell, he's not a bronze giant, and, like, knew everything. Because in the book, if you've ever read Ender's Game, MacReady is just weirdly just the best at fucking everything, while also being giant and huge and awesome.
Yeah, that's my primary complaint. Not to, like, piggyback on yours too much, but the characters are flat for the most part. Like, the human characters, they just exist to kind of move the plot along. And unlike the movie, I feel bad comparing this to the movie so much, but I feel like that's just the nature. I feel like if you did like a, if this were a theme podcast, you know, if you were doing a theme of like movies that surpass the source material, The Thing would be on it. It might be, you could argue it might be number one.
Certainly. Because I love the movie, I like the book. And the novella, like, one of those stories where, like, I like that in the movie it's in medias res, but it also sort of like has these assumptions that don't make any fucking sense. Because at one point, they find the alien, which we referred to several times as the thing, frozen in the ice outside of the ship that they found. And one character speculates, because it's obviously an alien. They're like, and they know that it's a shapeshifter. And they're like, but I think that was its original form. Why would you think that?
How could you possibly, like, know that?
How would you know, like, I can't be sure, but I'm pretty sure that's what it actually looks like, and it's normal. How would you know that?
I think that, to be honest with you, because in the novella, the other thing I really don't like about it is the humans seem to know, even if they're guessing, they have a fair amount of confidence about what they know about the thing. And to me, that kills some of the mystique. What makes the movie so horrifying is you know really nothing about this creature, and like what anything of it is, because even in the movie, I think we have no idea what this thing looks like.
Yeah.
How could you possibly know? Because in the book, the novella kind of gets into that a little bit, but they have so much confidence in how they're like dissecting this thing that it almost kills the mystique. They explain too much.
And I can understand the critique of the movie where, like, these scientists in Antarctica doing science here seem a lot less like scientists than they really ought to. The scientists in the novella are so... Everything is, well, if we do this experiment, blah, blah, blah. And like, not everybody in this group is gonna... Somebody is just the fucking cook. And like, but yet, they're all like going back and forth on like, well, you could do a serum test, MacReady. Like, yeah, I could definitely do a test like that. Yeah, because you were in medical school before you became a weatherman.
It's like, yeah, that is another thing, is MacReady is just a jack of all trades and master of everything in this.
Yeah.
Like, and not only is he the smartest, he's the handsomest, he's the strongest, and I just love him so much. Like, and that's great. Like, it's cool to have a character that, you know, you can tell who the favorite character was. You can tell that when this was written, he had a character that he loved more than all the other characters.
Yeah, the rest of them are all kind of like just very passively described. MacReady is re-described in almost every scene.
Several scenes he's in. It's like MacReady got mad with his, and it came out of his beautiful structured jaw, out of his handsome 6'6" frame. Like,
and he punched that door with his bronze fist, like attached to his bronze arm.
It's a lot. Honestly, this is a dude, I feel like when John Campbell wrote this, was like, listen, I just thought of this character, but I already love him more than you, and if I would sacrifice all of you for this one fictional character I just wrote.
Yeah, I mean, I know that we returned to this and we're really harping on it, but it is really fucking distracting. This is legit how the story is. All the way to the end, by the way.
Yeah, it's also, keeping in mind, so if you listen to this on Audible, this is a 2-hour audiobook.
Yeah.
It is short. And so if you're reading it, I don't think it's more than a couple hundred pages,
mm-hmm.
if that. And
yeah, it'd be like 200.
They dedicate a whole lot of ink to how handsome this dude is and how great his body is and how strong he is and how tan he is. There's a lot of time dedicated to this for a short story.
Yeah, and let's return to the idea that, like, MacReady in this, his job, he's a meteorologist, which is a fancy word for he's a weatherman. And another character in passing says, oh, MacReady, didn't you graduate from medical school before you decide to switch over to meteorology? As though that's a thing anyone has ever done.
It's a very disappointed parent.
He was about to start his residency as a doctor, a fucking doctor, and then he decided, you know what I want to do instead? Be a weatherman in Antarctica for some reason. And like, we don't respect weathermen today, and they have all the fucking technology in the world. How could it have been better decades in the past?
Tell you this though, if you're a weatherman, the best place to be is Antarctica.
Probably going to be snowy today.
It's like, I'll bet you know what? It's going to be cold and snowy today.
It's going to be...
It's like, you look outside, my God, he's the greatest weatherman that's ever lived. It's like he always knows what weather's going to be.
If he were only a doctor, we would have cured cancer by now.
If only you were a doctor. Honestly, like, that... it's one of those things, we'll get to this a little more later in the sort of comparing it, but I like in the movie, MacReady's just a pilot.
Yeah.
And he's in way over his head. And Kurt Russell, not saying anything you don't already know, is such a fucking good actor that he plays it beautifully.
Yeah.
And like the two characters, despite being the same character, could not be more different.
Yeah, at no point does anybody say, MacReady, the greatest helicopter pilot ever. Like, we're the smartest man ever. When you first meet him in the movie, he gets bested by a chess computer game from the 1980s. And then immediately pours scotch on it because he can't admit that he just lost to this thing. Like, that's the difference here. Now, the bronze god MacReady would have never done something so illogical.
Wouldn't even have lost to the computer.
He would have never lost that chess game because he was too fucking awesome. Yeah.
And like... It's funny though, because, like, you know, so much of this story, it feels like, it does feel like a companion piece to the movie,
mm-hmm.
because there's no similar. But the thing is, there's just enough differences. It's not like how if you read Lord of the Rings and then see Lord of the Rings, there you can see the story beats are pretty similar. They did some stuff. They filtered some stuff out. They hung and killed Tom Bombadil for being a terrible character that no one should like. But like, this feels almost like it's funny. It's the origin story. It's the origin material.
Yeah.
But it almost feels in a weird way kind of fan fiction-y.
Yeah, of this movie.
Yeah, of this movie. And it's fan fiction written by MacReady, because he's just
MacReady, who's the best.
That's kind of what this, even though it feels like, but it feels like that a little bit because of just, which is not fair to the novella, but we live in the world we live in, and that's just the plush reality of the movie exists. Yeah. And to get sort of the last sort of main dislike I have before we go to the sort of analysis part is the happy ending of this story was a popcorn fart to me.
Yeah, like the ending of the novella, because it's a happy ending, totally misses the fucking point I thought was being made.
It does not stick the landing.
It is like
at all.
We're about to transition here, but shocker, MacReady's very involved. Alright, so I think we should get into the spoilers.
Yeah, now I'm sorry.
Like, we're gonna belabor this point for a few seconds. We're about to spoil this novella.
That's from 1930.
It's nearly a century old.
And the movie's from 1980.
Yeah, like older than us.
Yeah, so if you're really offended by that,
we're here. This is now.
Yeah,
time to tune out. Read the novella. Come back.
It literally won't take that long.
Watch the movie.
It's an afternoon. Like,
yeah,
you have a great afternoon if you do both back to back. That's a lovely evening.
Yeah, start with the novella, then go into the movie because the movie's way better. But okay, analysis time. Yeah, the ending sucks because MacReady kills the thing with a fucking flamethrower. And most of the people survive, and they win because they're humans, and they're just fucking awesome.
Yeah, that, whenever, so I thought that the sort of teaser ending is they see a bird flying away, and you think, oh god, that's the point, is that the thing's gonna get away, because, and they just fucking kill the bird.
Yeah, that bird dies too.
And the bird wasn't even a thing.
It was just a fucking bird.
But they make sure to hammer home they got the thing, and the whole point. I love the sort of vagueness of the film, because you don't know at the end who's
human. If Childs or MacReady.
Either of them, or both.
You have no idea. I love the line that he goes, even if one of us was a thing, I don't think we're in the shape to do anything about it.
Like, that is why I feel like this novella doesn't have the reputation of, like, say, a lot of, like, famous movies that have books based on it. There's sort of an audience for both.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the example I always use is The Godfather.
Yeah.
There are people that staunchly say The Godfather book's better than the movie.
Yeah, and I can understand.
And vice versa. You know, there are people that think the movie is the gold standard of mob fiction, and the book's just solid. This, I would wager a bet that most people would say, yeah, the movie's better.
Yeah, no, I'm firmly in that camp where the movie is a superior version of this. And, like, most book people are always like, well, the book was better. And, like, there are times where that's true. If you ever read Aragon. By the way, that's a movie. I went to see that in theaters. Nobody remembers it. It was that awful. So, the ending of this really, like, falls flat on that. But, like, in defense of this novella, where I think that it does a little bit better than the movie, is the thing's ability to bluff in the novella is actually a little bit better than it is in the movie. And returning to my point where I was saying how much I like about how selfish each the thing is. So in the novella, the way that I read it is the character of Blair. He's a thing from the jump in my mind, because Blair in the movie and in the books has this moment where he freaks out and he realizes, oh, one of us could be a thing, and if one of us gets back and is a creature, this creature gets into society, that's the end of the human race, that's the end of the world. So I need to destroy all the vehicles, all the airplanes, everything, to make sure that, since if there's any doubt whatsoever, all of us basically need to die here so that it can't get back to the mainland. And I feel like in the movie, in the weak part of the movie, is that Blair has this wonderful 1980s computer that somehow has perfect estimates of, like, oh yeah, if it gets back to the mainland in, like, so many hours, it'll take over the whole world. How could you program a fucking computer today to give that kind of assessment versus this Tetris machine?
It's a very pessimistic computer.
I mean, It has this whole 1980s simulation of how the thing cell works. I'm like, I've seen better animation in Pac-Man. And not to get too much into that thing, but you feel in the movie that Blair, whenever he's destroying the airplanes and he's destroying the other vehicles, and he's sabotaging the radio to make sure that nobody comes in, he's human still. But how the novella, how Campbell sets it up, is he does all of that, but he is a thing. It's all a bluff. And it's because he just wants to be left alone. And he knows that there are other things out there. Other members of this expedition are already things. But he's willing to trade all of his compatriots so that he could be left alone, locked in a shed that he, of course, because he's a shapeshifter, can get out of at any point in time. And he can build his own goddamn ship and just leave. Or go wherever he was planning on going. Was it to the mainland or was it back to space? Who knows?
That is my favorite part of this story. That you're completely right. I think it absolutely trumps the movie, because whenever in the novella, when Blair's doing that, your mind just goes, oh, okay, this is clearly he's a person, because why would it? But I like that intrinsicness that everything is selfish, mm-hmm. that it doesn't matter, because it knows I can get out of this at any time. I'm not stuck here.
Yeah.
And there's something really horrifying about that.
Yeah, and I think that the movie tries to, like, call back to that idea, because when they go and confront Blair in the movie, they find he's built this whole cavern underneath the shed that they locked them in, and he was starting to build a ship, and it's kind of a nod to the novella. But, like, it's undercut by the whole scene where he's sitting there having this, like, nail-biting scene where he's looking at his simulation on his stupid computer. A thing that is doing a bluffing... that's bluffing the rest of them wouldn't have to go through that whole, like, because he's not doing that in front of another character.
He's doing that's what I would say, it's tricking the audience.
Yeah,
that only exists. It's like when a character, there's a big plot twist in a movie and the character doesn't do it to it when the character's alone, and he could easily be like, okay, I'm evil, I'm actually been evil this entire time, but he does something that's like good, so you as an audience member gets tricked.
Yeah,
and that's stupid. Like, not to disparage the person that writes. Well, the writer's long dead, right?
Campbell is, but like...
Oh, so good. John dead. Carpenter and, is... And fuck him. Like, what a stupid idea.
And John Carpenter's the one that wrote the movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's a Carpenter version of Blair has this whole scene where he's by himself to trick the audience. But like, it just reads as he was human then.
And you could make the... Because there are people that make the argument that he was being... Because he wasn't like bitten or anything or blood... It's a slow corruption.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I prefer the bluff.
I like the novella version where... Because every scene with Blair in the book is with other characters. So, like, there's no scene where he's by himself. Like, well, I can't risk the rest of the... I can't risk anybody getting back to the mainland. It's all done in front of other characters, and it's all for their benefit. That's why it's so much more brilliant than the novella.
Well, and the crux of this novella is they're never alone.
Yeah.
Unlike, so in the movie, they go to sleep, they leave each other's sight. The whole point of the novella is we don't leave each other's sight now because we can't trust anyone.
Yeah.
At all. And I think inherently, like we've said before, I think, I don't know, not today, but like everyone sort of kind of agrees that the thing is very much a metaphor for the AIDS scare.
Yeah.
And so the idea that, you know, any person you're interacting with could be infected, quote unquote. And that's really powerful, especially given the time it came out. It came out in the 80s.
1980s.
The height of the AIDS scare. And the novella came out, I think, in 20s or 30s. I think
it's in the 30s.
1930s, maybe. And it's the end of that excess post-sports, post-World War I, pre-World War II. But we're already having that mistrust of the Red Scare. It's the start of the origin of the Red Scare. The people act like the Red Scare only popped up post-World War II. We already had a distrust of the Russians.
Yeah.
There's fiction from that time frame of Russian spies. And who goes there is very much a metaphor of the person you're talking to isn't always who they appear. And the scariest thing is that the monster you're looking at looks just like you.
Yeah, and I think that this is very much like informed by that era between the two world wars, where we weren't a superpower. but we were already starting to be afraid of, like, those people are ideologically our opposite. And the fact that they look like us, because Russians look like people, because how people in popular fiction thought about themselves as thought of Americans, and this is unfortunate and not true necessarily, strictly so, but like people were depicted in movies as Anglo-Saxon looking people, white men and women.
Yeah.
And like, it's just unfortunate. And it, again, I want to stress, it's never been true that we've always been a multicultural nation. But in our popular fiction, it's always the plucky white people in the early fiction. And the fact that, like, Russians look just like our popular heroes, but they have that funny accent.
Yeah.
But some of them
can fake it.
Fake it real well.
That's what makes that so scary. And that's what makes this story such a metaphor for that, is that it's a perfect copy. Hmm. So it's not like you can even get a, gotcha, I figured you out, you're a spy. It is so perfect and one for one that there's really no way to know until it's too late.
Yeah.
By the time you know that it's a thing or a spy or whatever, it's too late. It's over.
Yeah.
And that is a kind of a horrifying concept, because, not to get too geopolitical, what made the Cold War so scary for a lot of people in the United States versus, say, the War on Terror, why they're very similar, and they both lasted about, in reality, the war in Afghanistan took 20 years. Think about really how long the Cold War lasted in its actual effect. Not that much longer.
Yeah.
Russians look like us. And that's scary. What's less scary is, well, these brown people don't really look that much like us, so it's not as scary, because you can easily point them out.
Yeah, because it's an other.
And the scariest other is one that looks just like you. And I say this speaking as someone, so I've said this before in the podcast, Jewish. And what one of the things that Jews sort of suffer from is we're imposter whites. Mm-hmm. Is that we're white passing, so we can sort of infiltrate and be like, and trick people into trusting us, and then we'll inevitably betray the white race for whatever, you know, whatever, even though there's no white race. But that sort of that concept of it is so terrifying, because it's when it looks like you and it talks like you and it acts like you, and then it can infiltrate you, that's fucking scary.
Yeah. I think that idea is done very well in this form of fiction. And like, the scene in the book that gets me, that there is no parallel for in the movie, is the one person they're a little suspicious of, and they have him imprisoned separately, and he's just playing, and he's just terrified, and the character at some point is just singing hymns, various religious hymns, for fucking hours on end. And it turns out at the end, whenever somebody realizes he's not singing anymore, and they go and find that somebody had slit his throat, and they go over to the body, and it turns out it was a thing the whole time. So that thing was singing hymns the whole time, and knew them word for word, just for hours on end, playing this guy cracking up, like, because it had some internal logic to doing this. But, like, the idea that it sang, and, like, they even point out, like, it sang all those songs to a god it clearly didn't believe in.
Like, that is I forgot about how good that line is.
Just, like, for hours on end.
There is something, what's so powerful about the novella, and the movie, too, but in general, the whole story, just the story in general. Well, to me, what's so effective is that when there's most sort of fictions about body snatchers or clones or whatever, usually when there's the tell, or when you figure out that this person isn't who they're claiming to be, it's sort of just, that's the end of it. Yeah, you figured me out, and it's like, what? It's the idea that this person you're talking to, you're looking them in the eye, they are the person you think they are. And they look at you the same way that the person looked at you, until you realize they're not, and then all of a sudden there's this fucking tentacle monster.
Yeah, there's no in-between stage where it has a monologue. where it's like, you got me.
There's no, to me, like, to compare it to another John Carpenter property, Halloween.
Yeah.
Michael Myers is the scariest when you don't know why he's doing what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
The Rob Zombie movies fucked that up because they explained, well, he had a sexually abusive mother and an overly religious father.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we know why he's horrible and fucked up. And that, to me, cheapens the scare.
Yeah, like, I have a love-hate relationship with him because, like, I like my... I like in The Thing that it's unknowable because it's an alien creature and should be unknowable. But, like, once you start getting to, like, a human character, oh, he's evil because he's evil. Like, well, I'm less interested in that. I think that's just the difference between the two of us.
Yeah, and I to me, it depends. I think, like, it has to be the right circumstances.
Yeah.
And I think the reason, like, it works, say, in Halloween is because that the therapist character saying, I looked in the boy's eyes and all I saw was pure evil. And there's something, we were off microphone. What did something you said earlier? Some people are just evil.
You're right. I did just say that.
Though. And
I
like the idea that Michael Myers had in the original story had two good parents, good siblings, never showed any signs of violence.
How dare you use my words against me?
But just one day, he was evil.
Damn, that's a good point.
It was just one day this kid snapped.
Yeah, turns out he was just, he's just fucking evil. Like, because I think that's more frightening than anything, is that, not to get topical again, but, like, to get topical, with the current, the recent shootings in Texas, is that I think that, like, a lot of these people who commit these horrible atrocities where they just go and massacre a whole group of people, I don't think that they're actually insane. I think that if you, right before, if you, they did some test on them, we talked about, that's what we were talking about off before we started recording this, is that they're just evil. They're like, he wasn't insane. He wasn't hearing voices. He's just a bad person. The reality of that is just soul-crushing. That there are just some people, and I'm not saying evil like as a supernatural force, the person was just bad. To get your mind around that is just, it's awful.
The monotony of evil is what makes it so scary, is that a person you can interact with can be capable of these horrible atrocities. And to get sort of back to the story, is it's sort of the same token. This person you're interacting with, you're spending days with, you're eating with, and you're mutually afraid because you're this thing you don't understand. The entire time they could have been just a thing.
Yeah.
And that's terrifying. We like our monsters obvious.
Mm.
Think about anything you watch that's like a scary movie. Mm-hmm. Like, people, even though there's scares in it, are you scared of Godzilla?
Not really, because like...
Because it looks like a monster.
Yeah.
So it does, it's doing the thing that monsters do. Okay, it's smashing buildings. That's okay, cool. Are you... I'm much more afraid of Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
He's a charming... Seems like a very affluent, friendly guy. But he also eats people.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is scarier.
Yeah. Well, I think we should transition into our parting thoughts and wrap up here.
So, yeah, my like sort of parting thoughts on this forever is that, like, this story, whether it's the movie, the novella, whatever, is so powerful because the idea of the monsters wearing a face that looks familiar and comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes your guard go down because you're with people you trust. And it's the ultimate form of betrayal, because only betrayal coming from you always say you can only be betrayed by your friends. But what if you're betrayed by somebody that just looked like your friend?
Yeah.
But perfectly. And that is such a nightmare-inducing concept and thought that it kind of stuck with me long after I finished this book. And it stuck with me long after the movie. I've seen the movie so many times, and that's what I always leave with my main takeaway, is that the scariest part of that story is that, one, you don't know what this thing wants, why it does what it does. You just know what it does. You just know it's doing the thing, dang thing again. And that is so fucking nightmare-inducing. Because at any point, if it's threatened enough, the monster comes out.
Yeah. Like, and it's 0 to 60. And a thought that I just had, like, now while you were talking about this is that imagine if this had gone on for even longer. Imagine that some people had survived and went out into society, and, you know, you were having a beer with, say, me, 10 years later. And, like, we're sitting here, like, remember that time with that thing? And, like, how all the rest of the expedition? And then I turned out to be a thing. I had kept up the fucking charade for 10 years or something like that. That would be even more of a mind fuck. Is that, like, because we would have all kinds of memories.
Extra, and the thing would have also made new memories.
Yeah, like, of this podcast. And I've been a thing this whole time.
What a clever way to avoid, you know. I'll tell you this. If I found out that I was a thing, and I all of a sudden became creepy, the only thought, if I was somewhere still in there, I'd be like, why the fuck do you still pay your bills? I don't want to pay my bills now. And yet I've been an alien monster this entire time, shape-shifting away, and I still, fine, I gotta pay my Discover bill this month, like.
Yeah, I mean.
The fact that there's probably, if this exists in real life, just know out there, person listening to this, there's probably an alien shape-shifting monster with a better credit score than you.
It's got that 850.
Yeah, like, how annoying is that? Like, God, you got a perfect credit score. I mean, seriously, like, my only regret upon learning that you're now a thing is I didn't ask you to borrow some money. Like, a large amount of money. I'm not going to pay him back. He's a thing.
All right, well. So I think it's your pick next. Do you have a pick for us in the month of June?
I gotta completely honest with you. I completely forgot to make a pick.
As we were doing this, I was like, oh boy.
Yeah,
I didn't actually, like, discuss this.
Before. So, you know what, Podcast Land? It's gonna be a surprise. I have genuinely no idea what I'm gonna pick now. Because I forgot how this works.
Yeah, like, we said a few, like, 2 months ago, we're going to start doing this thing where we tell the next.
Yeah.
It was like minute 25, I was like, oh, he has nothing.
I had all the intention in the world of having a pick. Just so you know, guys, I'm not transforming into
So, we'll see you next month.
Oh, by the way, Kevin, I just remembered what book I want to cover for next month, and it's a good thing I remembered before I left your house, because it's, you know, I can just talk about it right now, because one thing I can definitely confirm, it is the exact same day we recorded the podcast, and I'm definitely not alone at a different location. But yeah, I mean, if you don't believe me out there, I mean, Kev, I mean, right in front of me, tell the listeners that it's the same day.
Yes, Stephen, it is indeed the same day, and I'm Kevin, and I just cannot stress enough that it is the exact same day. So, Stephen, tell the listeners what book we're covering next month.
Thanks, Kevin. I appreciate that. So, the book I'm gonna pick for next month is My Rookie Year, the Audible original about Sidney Crosby's marvelous rookie 2005-2006 campaign for the Pittsburgh Penguins. I feel like it'd be a little fun change of pace. We don't get to do sports too often, so looking forward to it. Real excited about it. So, once again, see y'all next month.